Good afternoon, comrades. Welcome to our regular fortnightly discussion hosted by the Consistent Democrats. We've started studying the Manifesto of the Communist Party by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. We're now on chapter two, Proletarians and Communists. Ian's going to talk for about half an hour, I think, if that.
Something like
And
that.
then I would open it up for discussion. Okay, Ian, the floor is yours. Take it away,
Okay,
sir.
let me just check one thing before I actually start. Mark has just registered, so I will approve him. Okay. Right, I will start. Hang on a minute. Yeah, sorry, I've been slightly behind on this. Okay, this title of discussion is, this discussion is Manifesto of the Communist Party, Part 2, whose title is Proletarians and Communists. And obviously the manifesto itself is a key founding document of the Marxist movement of scientific socialism, in other words, of communism. And in the real sense of the term. And, this section, part two, is the core seminal section of the document. Part one is by way of an introduction and a sketch that really illustrates the application of the method of historical materialism to the whole of human history. Part two focuses on the struggle of communists within the current social system, i.e. capitalism, and on the relationship of the communists to the working class. And it lays out the key points about that relationship of communists with the working class when it says this. It says, in what relation do the communists stand to the proletariat as a whole? Hang on, I've lost my piece, lost my notes here. It says the communists do not form a separate party opposed to the other working class parties. They have no interests separate and apart from those of the proletariat as a whole. They do not set up any sectarian principles of their own by which to shape and mould the proletarian movement. The communists are distinguished from the other working class parties by this only. One, in the national struggles of the proletarians of the different countries, they point out and bring to the front the common interests of the entire proletariat, independently of all nationality. Two, hang on, here's Mark. Two, in the various stages of development from which the struggle of the working class against the bourgeoisie has to pass through, they always and everywhere express, represent the interests of the movement as a whole. The communists, therefore, are on the one hand practically the most advanced and resolute section of the working class, of every parties of every country, that section which pushes forward all others. On the other hand, theoretically, they have over the great mass of the proletariat the advantage of clearly understanding the line of march, the conditions, and the ultimate general result of the proletariat.
Can comrades please mute themselves so that we don't
Okay, I've done
interfere
that.
with the recording? Okay, sorry.
Yeah, this can be seen as an implicit criticism of some of today's rigid sectarian left-wing politics. The key question is not and never has been organisational separation from those movements whose leading views are questionable, but who organise class-conscious workers in some way. The key question for communists is our obligation to, as was quoted, to represent the interests of the movement as a whole, and to understand, quote, the line of march, the conditions, and the ultimate general results of the proletarian movement. As long as these are maintained, many different tactics are appropriate. That's my view anyway. And this is emphasized When the manifesto says this, it says, the theoretical conclusions of the communists are in no way based on the ideas or principles that have been invented or discovered by this or that would-be universal reformer. They merely express, in general terms, actual relations springing from an existing class struggle, from a historical movement going on under our very eyes. And from that, the manifesto goes on, and it says this. It says, the immediate aim of the communists is the same as that of all other proletarian parties. Formation of the proletariat into a class, overthrow of the bourgeois supremacy, conquest of political power by the proletariat. Now, in one sense, this shows how the document is dated, actually, because it's no longer really true that all other proletarian parties stand for the conquest of political power by the proletariat. I mean, this manifesto was written before imperialism developed and before bourgeois workers' party that were subordinate to imperialism, like Labour, for instance, were created. I mean, that is just a sign of how dated the document is, in my opinion. You know, it doesn't mean it's wrong. But anyway, moving on from that, the manifesto goes to talk about the specificity of the proletarian struggle. And it says this, the abolition of existing property relations is not at all a distinctive feature of communism. All property relations in the past have continually been subject to historical change consequent upon the change in historical conditions. The French Revolution, for instance, abolished feudal property in favour of bourgeois property. The distinguishing feature of communism is not the abolition of property generally, but the abolition of bourgeois property. But modern bourgeois property is the final and most complete expression of the system of producing and appropriating products that is based on class antagonisms, on the exploitation of the many by the few. So in that sense, the theory of the communists may be summed up in the single sentence, abolition of private property. But then the manifesto goes on to reply to various bourgeois calumnies and the bourgeois outcry against the idea of the abolition of private property, and that, you know, particularly the implication that they are in favour of confiscating the property of the workers, which of course is nonsense, because simply because as the manifesto points out, it says, does wage labour create any property for the labourer? And it's not a bit. It creates capital, i.e. that kind of property which exploits wage labour, and which cannot increase except upon condition of begetting a new supply of wage labour for fresh exploitation. Property, in its present form, is based on the antagonism of capital and wage labour. And then they go on to examine this relationship a bit more, in some more depth. They say, to be a capitalist is to have not only a purely personal, but a social status in production. Capital is a collective product, and only by the united action of many members, nay, in the last resort, only by the united action of all members of society, can it be set in motion. So capital is therefore not only personal, it's a social power. When, therefore, capital is converted into common property, into the property of all members of society, personal property is not thereby transformed into social property. It is only the social character of the property that is changed. It loses its class character. And the attempt by capitalist ideologues to claim that the communists want to abolish the meagre property that workers possess is just refuted. They say we by no means intend to abolish this personal appropriation of the products of labour, an appropriation that is made for the maintenance and reproduction of human life, and that leaves no surplus therewith to command the labour of others. All that we want to do away with is the miserable character of this appropriation, under which the labourer lives merely to increase capital and is allowed, hang on, John is here, and is allowed to live only insofar as the interests of the ruling class requires it. And likewise, they pull apart the claim that the abolition of bourgeois property represents the abolition of something called freedom, that they put in quotes. And they say about this, they say, by freedom is meant, under the present bourgeois conditions of production, free trade, free selling, free selling and buying. And then they say, you are horrified at our defect intending to do away with private property. But in your existing society, private property is already done away with for 9/10 of the population. Its existence for the few is solely due to its non-existence in the hands of those 9/10. In one word, you reproach us for intending to do away with your property. Precisely so. That's exactly what we intend. And they take on one by one the various bourgeois objections. For instance, they say, it has been objected that upon the abolition of private property, all work will cease and universal laziness will overtake us. According to this, bourgeois society ought to have long ago gone to the dogs through sheer idleness, because those of its members who do work acquire nothing, and those who acquire anything do not work. So they sum it all up, some aspects of this. Anyway, the manifesto lays out its indictment of capitalism and why it must disappear. And it says this, it says, the selfish misconception that induces you to transform into eternal laws of nature and of reason, the social form springing from your present mode of production and form of property, historical relations that rise and disappear in the process of production, this misconception you share with every ruling class that has preceded you. What you see clearly in the case of ancient property, what you admit in the case of feudal property, you are of course forbidden to admit in the case of your own bourgeois form of property. And then they deal with likewise with the bourgeois outcry against the communist view on the family. And what they say is this, on what foundation is the present family, the bourgeois family, based? On capital, on private gain in its completely developed form, this family exists only among the bourgeoisie. But this state of thing finds its complement in the practical absence of the family among the proletarians and in public prostitution. And they say the bourgeois family will vanish as a matter of course when its complement vanishes, and both will vanish with the vanishing of capital. So they say, do you charge us with wanting to stop the exploitation of children by their parents? And to this crime, we've plead guilty. And they go on. They say that the bourgeois claptrap about family and education, about the hallowed correlation of parents and child, becomes all the more disgusting by the action of modern industry. All family ties among the proletarians are torn asunder and their children transformed into simple articles of commerce and instruments of labour. Of course, we know that from the 19th century. the children being worked to death, you know, and that was very common, you know. And then there's the famous allegation that the communists would introduce a so-called community of women. And they say the bourgeois sees his wife as a mere instrument of production. He hears that the instruments of production are to be exploited in common, and naturally can come to no other conclusion that the lot of being common to all will likewise fall to the women. He's not even the suspicion that the real point aimed at is to do away with the status of women as mere instruments of production. And I suppose the next passage might well once have been seen as quite contentious, but given what we know about the proclivities of today's Epstein class, it actually seems quite mild, I think. Because they say this, they say, our bourgeois, not content with having wives and daughters of their proletarians at their disposal, not to speak of common prostitutes, take the greatest pleasure in seducing each other's wives. And bourgeois marriage is in reality a system of wives in common, and thus, at the most, what the communists might possibly be reproached with is that they desire to introduce, in substitution for a hypocritically concealed, an openly legalised community of women. For the rest, it's self-evident that the abolition of the present system of production must bring about it, with it the abolition of the community of women springing from that system, i.e. of prostitution, both public and private, which implies that all bourgeois women are prostitutes, you could argue. But in the light of things like the Epstein business, I think, as I said, it seems quite mild. Anyway, they go on to another crucial point about the question of nations, and they say, and you know, then the question of the charge that communists want to abolish nations and nationality, and the response to this, I think, it's quite pithy, and it's worth quoting in full. It's not very long. It simply says this. The working men have no country. We cannot take from them what they have not got. Since the proletariat must first of all acquire political supremacy, must rise to be the leading class of the nation, must constitute itself as the nation, it is insofar itself national, though not in the bourgeois sense of the word. National differences and antagonism between peoples are daily more and more vanishing owing to the development of the bourgeoisie. To freedom of commerce, to the world market, to uniformity in the mode of production and in the conditions of life corresponding thereto. The supremacy of the proletariat will cause them to vanish still faster. United action of the leading civilized countries at least is one of the first conditions for the emancipation of the proletariat. In proportion as the exploitation of one individual by another will be put an end to, the exploitation of one nation by another will also be put an end to. In proportion as the antagonism between classes within the nation vanishes, the hostility of one nation to another will come to an end. Now, I think actually in the epoch of imperialism, in terms of capitalism abolishing distinctions between nations, imperialist capitalism produced a counter tendency to this. I mean, setting the peoples of oppressor imperialist countries against each other, as we know, and even more against those in countries who are the victims of imperialism. But Marx and Engels, of course, didn't live long enough to see this and to fully address it. And we have to address it today by formulating concrete Marxist positions on every national question to which imperialist capitalism gives rise. But I think overall what the manifesto says is true, that capitalist development, in spite of all this, is undermining the basis for nations and nationalism. Because imperialism itself is an expression of the fact that the productive forces created by capitalism have outgrown the nation state, which is actually obsolete, which I think is a point to consider. Going on, the manifesto rightly dismisses the objections to communism from a religious, a philosophical, and generally from an ideological standpoint as, quote, not deserving of serious examination. It asks this, it says, what else does the history of ideas prove than that intellectual production changes its character in proportion as material production is changed? The ruling ideas of each age have ever been the ideas of its ruling class. And the manifesto concludes from that when people speak of the ideas that revolutionise society, they do but express the fact that within the old society, elements of a new one have been created, and that the dissolution of the old ideas even keep pace with the dissolution of the old conditions of existence. And in saying that, it notes that the proletarian revolution is different from previous revolutions, because, and this is a key point, it says, one fact is common to all past ages, viz. That the exploitation of one part of society by the other. No wonder then that the social consciousness of past ages, despite all the multiplicity and variety it displays, moves within certain common forms or general ideas, which cannot completely vanish except with the total disappearance of class antagonisms. And the communist revolution is therefore the most radical rupture with traditional property relations. No wonder that this development involved the most radical rupture with traditional ideas. And then, having dismissed all these anachronisms, it goes on to the practical matters. It says, of how we do this. It says, we've seen above that the first step in the revolution by the working class is to raise the proletariat to the position of ruling class, to win the battle of democracy. The proletariat will use its political supremacy to wrest, by degrees, all capital from the bourgeoisie, to centralise all the instruments of production in the hands of the state, i.e. of the proletariat organised as the ruling class. So that's a key phrase that we've come across before, I think. And it says, and to increase the total of productive forces as rapidly as possible. And there's a list of basic demands at the end, which are fine, but they're of their time, and many of them been superseded by other much more detailed programmes. And I'm not going to read them out. I mean, everybody's probably read them, should have read them anyway. And Marx and Engels themselves say that these measures will, of course, be different in different countries. And they note that these are applicable to advanced countries, as they say, in particular. 10 demands, which are the basis of much more detailed elaborations later, I think. You know. But what's also striking is the resemblance between the conclusion of this part of the manifesto and later, more detailed elaborations again, such as Marx's critique of the Gotha program, which we touched on in studying Lenin's State and Revolution earlier on. And this is where they say this. They say, when in the course of development, class distinctions have disappeared and all production has been concentrated in the hands of a vast association of the whole nation, the public power will lose its political character. Political power, properly so called, is merely the organised power of one class for oppressing another. If the proletariat during its contest with the bourgeoisie is compelled, by the force of circumstances, to organise itself as a class, if, by means of a revolution, it makes itself the ruling class, and as such sweeps away by force the old conditions of production, then it will, along with these conditions, have swept away the conditions for the existence of class antagonisms and of classes generally, and will therefore have abolished its own supremacy as a class. And, you know, that concept in the Communist Manifesto is the withering away of the state, actually. It doesn't say that, but that's what it is, as it's dealt with more concretely by Marx after the Paris Commune, as was cited by Lenin that we talked about earlier. Which, of course, it accompanies the higher stage of capitalist society, as Marx later elaborated again, whereas the manifesto says, in place of the old bourgeois society with its classes and class antagonisms, we shall have an association in which the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all. And I'll leave it there, and I'll open it up for discussion. Thank you, comrades. Cheers.
Cheers, Ian. Very good talk. I thought it was interesting that chapter was particularly short. Mind you, I've read the manifesto itself. It's quite short compared to other Marxist literature. Okay, comrades. It would be helpful that those who aren't speaking should be muted in order to not interfere with the recording. those that wish to speak, obviously those on not on camera should use their virtual hand if possible. Those on camera can just use their real hand, as I can see you. Okay, who wants to start? This might be quite a short one. Anybody?
I think Max wants to speak.
Yeah,
okay, go on, Max. Yeah.
To beat a dead horse. I was just looking up, trying to figure out the start of the Socialist Labor Party that I'm always harping about, the Leon. It actually started in 1876. I'm not sure. It was sort of a parallel with the IWW, but I can't find the, what year that started, but late 1800s. And historically, it's like, it's just left out. It's left out a lot because they didn't make a revolution, but they did a lot of other stuff. They did a lot of striking, you know. So in a way, clearly, Socialist Labor Party in the United States, IWW is kind of everybody calls it anarcho-syndicalist, and maybe it is, but it is also very socialist, very Marxist, especially the Socialist Labor Party. They did have some fighting amongst themselves over some issues, but you get the feeling that society in general, at least by the time the Socialist Labor Party formed, and probably before, because nothing comes from thin air. What I'm saying is Marx was very influential, as well as I think the level of class consciousness is probably higher back then, at least in the United States and probably Europe too. I don't know. Anyway, I in terms of putting it into action, that's where the ideas, at least, of the Socialist Labor Party, the Leninism, came in. But, you know, the Lenin himself was dead by 1914, never got to see the Russian Revolution. Anyway, that's just my roots, and I'll leave that to pick up.
Ian, do you want to pick up that point before I bring Marie in?
Well, I haven't got much to say on that. I mean, it sounds very interesting. It's not something I know very much about. Well, I know a little bit about it, but very little. You know? it's stuff I might have to invest
in. Well, it sounds to me more anarchist.
In the 30s came around, you had AFL-CIO coming together. They were considered actually conservative unions, the Federation of Labor and the AFL-CIO, Congress Industrial Organizations. It kind of put a squash on it, but at the same time, it was a sign of a lot of activity. Yeah.
Just let me say, I wouldn't dismiss this at all. I think it's important. I mean, it's important in the same sense that William Morris is important about British socialist history. It sort of covers a similar period. Very, very interesting, actually. William Morris was anti-imperialist before Bolshevism, and he supported the Mahdi against General Gordon when they killed him, you know? When the Sudanese Mahdists actually killed Duke Gordon, and that was in the 1880s. I can't remember exactly when it was, but I don't think Daniel de Leon was an anarchist. I think he was some sort of pioneer. He was a socialist. In the context, in the late 19th century and very early 20th, you know.
Yeah, the Social Slavery Party still exists.
I do think it's important historically, yeah. But I don't know.
It's kind of like that quote that everybody always throws around at Trotsky saying, well, things haven't ripened enough, they're actually rotten. It's like, well, in a way, it's a missing link just to remind ourselves of history since Marx. You know, that there is, it's kind of like when I watched the eclipse the other night, it's like, oh, it came right on time. It's like, it just proves what I believe. It just like reinforces what we believe. Because these days, a lot of times we're getting caught up in kind of a lot of, I don't know what the word is. You get caught up in some of this bullshit that a lot of the so-called socialists are talking about identity politics. You know what I mean? Back to basics, kind of like, yeah, this class struggle's still there, underneath everything, even though there's no big factories in the United States. I bet you there's factories somewhere.
I think we need to get back to the text, if that's okay. Thanks, Pat.
The output of text is my point. One of them. I don't know.
Maui, what do you want to say?
You're muted.
Mute, that's it. Yeah, thanks, Ian, for having rendered this, which is quite complex. And then when you read Marx, you get the impression that it is quite simple, but at the same time, it is a complex issue of the relationship between property and social organization, and social organization and production. So I'm going to go through notes, which I have not very well organized. I thought the document meant to explain that the communists, I agree with, it's very important to see myself, I see myself as a communist. I know it is quite pretentious, but I would like to think so. And so it seems to me that as a communist, I and others like me feel that we belong to any movement which is trying to progress, and which is not defending a nation or an ethnic group, but the interests of the whole of humanity. So that is, you know, that is key, really. And it's not like we have a badge, communist. It is the behavior and the consciousness, because not only we have this universal conception, but also we cultivated in meetings like this one. This is why it's important to give importance to the texts, like Paul was saying, because here we train to bring consciousness to others when they are in struggle. And this is the role of the communists. We are not against the abolition of all property. We are against the abolition of existing property relations, because property, in the end, when it is nationalized, passes in the hand, when it is a worker state, in the hand of the community, of the whole community. And therefore, property has not been abolished, but it has passed into the hand of those who were the majority, those who are not, who don't have property, but who, and by the way, those who have been expropriated themselves have an interest in this universal form of property, because when they were exploiting others, they were not really living life. And so now they have a proper function like everybody else. So it's not like we try to remove the capitalist system. We oppose them monopolizing and appropriating property. The capital, I saw there was an interesting point, that capital is a collective product. which is new to me because I had never appreciated this. Indeed, it is why I think humanity is in such a plight now, because this collective product has to change hands on a world scale. It needs to be converted into common property, and on a universal scale, it seems to me today. So we do away with the miserable character of private appropriation, under which the labourer lives solely to make capital for the ruling class. We are accused of wanting to abolish individuality and freedom, and yes, we abolish them, but for the bourgeois, for the individuality and the freedom of the bourgeois class. The individuality and freedom of the bourgeois class is just to make itself the sole appropriator of the wealth produced by the whole of society. This is what they call freedom, and it's very clear. And when they talk about individuality, what they talk is about the form of life which they have in order to defend that freedom, which is with all their prisons and all the rest of prisons and the army. So Marx says, you accused us of wanting to do away with private property. But in capitalism, private property is inexistent, like Ian mentioned, for 9/10 of the population. So what we are accused of is farcical all the time. Capitalism blames us for doing away with private property form that requires, Marx sums up, a private property form that requires for its existence the non-existence of any property for the immense majority of people. I think this is very pregnant because this is what's happening today, which we see developing when, in order to not only defend itself, but to exist, Israel completely denies the existence of others. And this is where it leads. Back from Marx, it has evolved into this. Yeah, I would like to just tackle another two or three points. The eternal laws, so when capitalism was fighting feudalism, it was highlighting all the shortcomings of feudalism. And it was presenting itself as the defender of superior laws. And then when it took over, because it was not representing the whole of society, but only its own class, it turned justice and equality and liberty, fraternity and all this into eternal laws of social forms. But in fact, they do not implement it, and they cling to these idealist notions in order to justify their regime. So they didn't justify the other regimes or the feudal regime, but they justify their own. And I think the consequence of that is capitalism cannot imagine that it is transitory and that it's going to be overcome by another form, and that what it was considering as eternal laws, it never implemented, and that there is no need for such forms, for eternal laws and all these concepts which it produced in order to make it believe that it was going to be eternal. And then this question of the nations, I think this is very productive. It's very relevant. It seems to me that in the experience which I make International Ukraine Anti-Fascist Group and in the Anti-Fascist International and in contacts with you comrades, I find that it is necessary now to really insist on the fact that ideas which in the text are called intellectual production, so that's ideas, the ideas that are developed, they change with the material production. So you have a change in the mode of production leads to changes of ideas and changes also of what one considers just or correct, because there was a time when the woman, and still until now, there is misogyny. That comes from the society we are in, and it is still here, and it doesn't really disappear that easily in the worker state, because there has to be a complete change, not just of the productive forces, but of the intellectual production, which is linked each time better at a more elevated level as production becomes universal or for everybody and not just for the benefit of a few. So I think there is that interlinking here. And then, yeah, it seems to me it is very often that comrades can think that it's Trump doing things, or it's the leaders who are making the changes in society. Whereas in fact, the mass of humanity which is making history, and the intellectual production of humanity is enormous, has an enormous potential, and it is being grabbed and it's being curtailed and it's being appropriated by the capitalist system to make its weapons and its profits and its the degradation of life that it does. Yeah. That's it, finished.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Molly. Follow that, as they say. Ian, do you want to come back on that?
No, I mean, I don't see anything particularly I disagree with in that. So, I mean, I think it's just adds more to what we've been talking about, really. You know, there's nothing contentious about that.
Yeah.
It's interesting stuff, you know. But yeah, fine.
I think you and Molly have obviously both acknowledged that at the time when it was written, compared to now, capitalism has changed quite substantially in the imperialist form in a way that just didn't exist.
Yeah.
The time when Marx was writing the manifesto. Who else would like to come in? Go on, Molly.
Yeah, sorry, I don't want to go in front of anybody. There was a very fine passage about we abolish eternal truth, religion, all religion, all morality, in opposition to all previous past historic experience. So not only is, I think comrades could look into that the working class is the last class in the chain of exploitation. So now, after all these different classes which took power in history, the working class is not in a position to become now a ruling class that exploits. And so as it takes power, which it will because it's a necessity of life, as it takes power, it does express the interest of everyone, because it is not expressing or representing any property. And so it's not like it was born with different genes. It is that its position in society and in history makes it incapable, and probably not wishing, to become a new exploiter. And so the consequence of that is that all these concepts, the values, the eternal truth, and including democracy, even democracy as we have seen on the previous discussion, I think it was about with Lenin, democracy gets abolished as well. There is no need of democracy. Once there is no classes, there is no need of democracy because the relationship between the humans is already at the level at which it is that you, Emma?
Yes.
Yeah? Emma, you could take that on, couldn't you? Just don't you want to say two or three words?
No, you're doing fine, Marie. Carry on.
Well, I'm chickening out. Yeah, and so what I meant to say, to link the fact that the working class, and then comrades need to look at the text, not just at other things, and to link it to today, because what Israel, why is imperialism, how has it created atomic weapons, and why is it now deploying them again and quite in a overt way? You know, they have five countries in Europe where they have the actual bomb under the ground in silos in five countries, and six with Britain. Yeah. Why do they need this sort of thing? What is the aim, or what is the thrust which is pushing them into developing these things and then developing all these technological means, which, yes, some of it is very good, but mostly they want to replace the human being. And so this is criminal and genocidal, and we have reached the point of this when they prepare to kill, and not just in Gaza. They prepare for killing, and so this is why this text is so important, because here we can argue from the beginning every aspect of what is happening, and not just lecture people, but give a view of the historic development which capitalism is hiding and doesn't want to discuss. This is why communism is banned, and books and anything which is Marxist doesn't get distributed. I mean, they have two or three things, but in general, Marxism is banned. And all that we are discussing today is banned. This is why we have to go back. I suggest we go back later on, at a different time, when we have absorbed some of this, to return to new aspects that we have not looked at today. Yeah.
Thanks, Marie.
Thank you, Marie.
John, I don't want to put you on the spot. You don't have to speak if you don't want to, but I noticed that you put in the chat there's a subjective layer going on. I just wonder, would you like to elaborate? And then
you know, there is a subjective factor. You know, it isn't all mechanical that it's written that so-and-so theory would have been discovered anyway, or this or that. You know, I mean, you know, there's a subjective factor in, you know, in that humans, you know, in that, you know, in events, you know, it's not just that, that these things inevitably happen, that, you know, that, you know, F. Trotsky had survived the assassination, you know, attempt. You know, present-day Trotskyism, if he had survived a couple more years, present-day Trotskyism would look far different to what it does today.
Yeah, okay.
The fact was that he was killed at a certain point, and that had a profound effect on the outcome of the Trotskyist movement, and that. So, that, you know, there's a subjective factor. You know, things aren't inevitable and aren't, you know, you know, and Einstein's theory and whatever, and Marx's theory. You know, it's not all there to be discovered in that sense. I mean, it comes about when it comes about, and there's a subjective factor. That's all I think.
Yeah. And Jonathan, I think even Mark and Angel would argue that, or would argue, sorry, or did argue that that nothing was inevitable. So thanks for raising that point. Ian, do you want to come back on
it? I think there is a subjective factor. It's quite true. And Marx and Engels played a very important role. If they had not lived, would someone else have played the same role? Probably, but you can't be absolutely certain, because all these things remain to be elaborated and discovered. And maybe I'm sure someone else would have been, you know, thinking along the same lines, but they got there first. And that he who gets there first actually plays a major role in sort of affecting the movement in the future that was built around it. Yeah. And it really is a bit hypothetical, that is, because I know it's true. You have to think about, yeah, well, what might have happened otherwise? And it's really, you only are getting into hypotheses, you know, that you can never know the answer to. I do think it was in tune with objective reality that there was, you know, it's no accident that these theories emerged in the middle of the Industrial Revolution in Britain. And Marx was particularly profoundly influenced by what happened in Britain, and eventually he moved to Britain. He had no choice in some ways, but because it was the persecution of people like him on the continent, but he moved to Britain. And Britain was the centre of capitalism at that time, you know, so he had the chance to study at close quarters. And that's where Das Kapital comes from, you know, from his work, study, you know, with Engels, who was a manufacturer in Manchester in a crucial period, had a deep insight into what was going on and what, you know, he was in a pole position to examine it, really, and to deepen his understanding and to write stuff that's, you know, and of course it's a huge job. He never finished it, you know, but you can't really say whether what would have happened if he hadn't have lived, because he did live, you know, and the same goes for many other things. But I don't hold the theory that whatever happened was what was inevitable. It was, you know, it was always inevitable. That is a, what's the word? That's a mechanical view of history, I think. You know, that there are possibilities where things could have been different. I mean, the Spanish Civil War, if it had been better people in certain organisations in the Spanish Civil War, there might have been a proletarian revolution. You know, if Nin had not been weak and a centrist, he might have led a sizable left-wing party that could have saved the situation, but he didn't. He joined the Popular Front instead, and his party did that. I mean, that was an example of things that went wrong, and Rosa Luxemburg made errors in the sense that she never understood the need for a party until it was too late, a separate party to the SPD, you know, until it was too late. So, I mean, there are situations where things could have been done differently, and it's rather obvious, really. But that's a product of it. It's life is full of unevenness, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, if Trotsky had not been murdered in 1940, if he'd have lived another 10 years or something, it would have been you could imagine quite different scenarios, you know.
Somebody else would have killed him, I think.
Yeah. Or if somebody else had come along, if Abraham Leon had not been murdered in Auschwitz, he was a very, very capable theoretician, probably more capable than some of the people who survived, you know, undoubtedly, actually. Worked very closely with Ernest Mandel. He proved to be very, very flexible. You know.
Very what? What's the word?
What's that?
What did you say?
Ernest Mandel proved to be too flexible, and you know.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of.
But Abraham Leon worked with Ernest Mandel, and if he had survived, what might have happened? Who knows? You know.
I can't remember why I rejected it now, but I did it.
Never mind, Conroy, we're being recorded too.
Yeah, we shouldn't be.
Can you continue?
We should speak it well.
Well, yeah. Talking about, I feel like I opened up Pandora's box.
Batch, please, Ian, continue.
Yeah, but the point I'm making is we should speak in, when it's our turn, sort of thing. But, I mean, yeah, I think if Mandel had more backbone, or if he'd been, you know, if Leon had survived, who knows what might have happened. You know, there are different possibilities, aren't there? There's centrism. Centrism has been a real problem, you know. I mean, even in the stuff we've been doing, if people had more, you know, Corbyn is no good. It's been proved several times. Even within the framework of the existing left, there are people who've got more bottle than Corbyn. I think of George Galloway, who's a damaged person, but he's got more bottle than Corbyn. You know, it's just the political flaws are different, you know, and things let the chips fall where they may, unfortunately. Accident does play a role in history, and the subjective factor is very important. And Johnny's quite right about that.
Thanks, Ian.
Mm-hmm.
Who else would like to come in? There's a few people who haven't spoken yet, so would any of you like to come in? I think we've lost one person along the way. We've lost.
No, everybody's still here.
Oh, so yeah. Okay, yes. So I had to change the view of my Zoom. does anyone else want to come in? I think we ought to, Marie, did you want to come in?
You're muted,
Marie.
Ian, you talked about when the children were working. Marx was writing at the time when children were very young children were sent to work. But I think this is happening on a world scale.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not happening in Britain, so I think the document is valid, entirely valid, if you look at it from an international point of view. And the acuteness of it is very valid. It is now giving an inkling, it is giving us means to foresee what's happening next, what's AI, what are these things, what do they want, why do they want things to be done for people instead of, and what's going to happen to the system when they have replaced people by machines. That sort of thing.
Yeah, I was going to come back on that, but I forgot what I was going to say, because he mentioned that subject a bit earlier on, and I forgot about it, because I can't remember what I was going to say. But yeah, I think capitalism is in, you know, it's desperately searching for sources of profit, and the profit system is decaying, and they're getting less and less profit in the conventional sense, and more fraud and shortcuts and means of, you know, more and more scams are happening and less industrial development is happening. And I think AI is another example. You know, it's a means of short-circuiting and doing away with labour. But the problem is that the source of value is labour, human labour. So the thing becomes useless and it just becomes another load of constant capital capital that's not productive, and it will depress the price of profit even more, actually, and make the system into a total dead duck. And you can see, I mean, the system is bizarre now anyway, it really is bizarre. And AI is, oh God, you know, I mean, you can see what it could be used for under socialism, but you know, so it could be used as a tool for planning an economy. But under capitalism, it's become something utterly wretched, you know. And, well, that's all I can say. All these things are are the result of the prolonged decay of capitalism, the fact that nobody has actually put together a movement to overthrow it as yet.
Paul wants to speak, no?
Obviously, I was going to say, continuing on from that, yes, I'll bring you in a moment, Max. Continuing on from that, when I started reading Marxist material, this is what we mean when we talk about the crisis of overproduction. And then, of course, you alluded to it with the, you also mentioned about the rate of profit to fall. Those were two terms I learned as I started to read about Marxism. And my goodness, we're seeing that now, aren't we, where the capitalists are constantly trying to find new ways to keep that system going. Max.
You're muted. Yes.
Yeah. I hear a lot of, people saying, shit, I lost my train of thought. One thing is, I think artificial intelligence, actually with some about physicists, I think, that it's not intelligence. I like that because it makes sense to me. It's not really intelligence. It's just a machine that can do something. This whole idea that, oh, they're going to take, it's like, everybody's trying to do the Ray Bradbury, Isaac Asimov thing. And, oh, who's going to take over? I mean, this is like the liberals. I don't know. It's not true. I don't think it's just another tool to hit us over the head. And we shouldn't let any of these things discourage us, is what I think. Yes, capitalism is rotten, and it puts on all kinds of masks that fool us, that trick people into thinking things are something else. And also, the fact that Trump came out a few weeks ago and said, started doing this anti-communism stuff. This is not a joke. This is real. It's not because he did. If people say, oh, because he's crazy and he's responding to something and there's something and something and trying to save his face. That, yeah, he's a little crazy. But this is not just Trump. This is real. This is worse than what they did in the 50s. This is anti-communism. I grew up in the United States. Anti-communism is like it's baked in the bread of America. And now they're coming back with this. I always, all my life, knew this would eventually happen, even whether it's fascism or whatever. They're putting people in jail. They're killing people. And they're killing us all. You know, all the people that are getting, these are the things, that are new. Or it's like it's increasing repression everywhere so that they can do whatever it is they're trying to do in their death throes, et cetera. So it's not comforting me when people say, well, capitalism is falling apart. They're not going to, some people say that. You guys aren't saying that, but other people on the left say things like, oh, well, it's going to crumble, but we have to be ready to replace it when it does make its big flubs and this is the problem again, organization. We have to build the organization. And I also want to just quickly add that although I am basically on the same page with Lenin and Trotskyism, et cetera, I always have had, because of my Deleonism and my kind of a distrust of the vanguard theory, not because it's wrong, but if it's done incorrectly, it can be used, and it is used by a lot of fake, the half of the Trots that get everything wrong. It's used as a kind of elitism, kind of like the academics are the ones who always bring the ideas to the stupid working class. I was accused long ago, and I still hold this, and it was a badge of honor by people in the SWP of having a workers' deviation. This is because I was focusing on, the real activism. I'm not criticizing anybody here. I'm just saying this is part of the whole ideology that I always had some problems with. Like, it's not necessarily going to be like that it's the ruling, that the leadership of the proletariat is going to have all the answers. The workers might have some answers themselves. You know, we have to, you can accuse me of being anarcho-syndicalist, but I think we have to have the right mix and the right vehicles of organization. And this is why I urge people to read, just to read a little bit about the Social Slave Party and the Wobblers and what they did, despite the fact that they didn't win the revolution. They did a lot. I mean, we have May Day because of these things that I'm talking about. So, you know, as usual, you know. But I noticed this years ago. It's like I also noticed throughout the years, and you know, maybe it's because I have a pain in the ass personality, but I don't think so. People are always shutting me up. Here, okay, I'm undisciplined. But no, when I go to IMT meetings, DSA, they would shut me up, not because I was talking too much, because of what I was saying. I'm not accusing you here of this today because I spoke out of time. That's not, I'm talking about, like, in general. When I brought up certain things, they were like, no, let's not talk about that. But in the DSA, it was because they don't want to talk about that at all. Or in the PSL with that guy, Vijay Prashad, I remember asking him when he spoke, well, what about, you know, the whole Trotsky, you know, the different approaches. And I think, you know, even though he's right about this thing with Joanna Gray, he was right about some letter that's fishy. It doesn't look right. And he's probably correct on this issue. But he's still, you know, a person can be right or wrong. And Prashad is a perfect example of what I'm talking about. It's kind of like these people have comfortable lives. You know what I mean? They're not really workers, a lot of these big shot, you know, socialist intellectuals. I'm not talking about present company. I'm talking about people like Prashad. And they're often tied to established, you know, Stalinist type of reformist things. But at the same time, I defend the game, you know. It's that whole Spartacist thing, but I always have a distrust. I'm always questioning everything, even amongst us, and I think we should all do the same.
I think Mark.
Thanks, Max. Mark C, you'd like to come in.
Yeah, I was just thinking that we have an immense communication problem, and Max touched on one thing. Trump talking about communists. As far as I can see, it's even communists and the left are even less evident in the States than they are here. Proper communists and proper left. We've got the problem in this country as well, where you've got silly people from, to put it mildly, silly people from Reform calling Labour hard left. You've got people calling left communist fascists. And then posting stuff on social media that just exaggerates things. You've got people that are pushing the idea that National Socialism, Hitler's National Socialism was socialism. And we're not really keeping up with this. And I think it's really important because if I take myself, for instance, that means I'm being put in the category of Yvette Cooper in the Labour Party. In Trump's instance, he's calling the Democrats communists. So it's like, it's just not, I think what I'm trying to say is that we need to communicate better and we need to educate people a bit more because the right are actually winning on that. They really are. That's all I've got to say. That's what I think anyway.
Thanks, Mark. Personally, I think you've made a good point because when I look at the last US elections from over here, as far as I could see it, Kamala Harris didn't really feature, and And in campaign terms, the only thing they had going for it was we're not Trump. There was no alternative programme to communicate to people, from what I could see. And
yeah.
I'm kind of square now, but all these liberals, who aren't really left-wing at all, they just say that they pretend they are. They were jumping up and down with no sense of reflection about what it is that they were apparently fighting for. We're not Trump. This doesn't cut it. And people are still not getting that. Sorry, Ian, that's my personal take on the last US election. Ian, do you want to come back on any of this?
Not at the moment. I mean, I think Marie wants to speak though.
Ah, go ahead, Marie. You're muted at the moment.
Yeah, thank you. I think there is another little aspect which needs to be tackled is when we're talking now what Marx saw at the time when capitalism was affirming itself. So now we are very clearly at a time when capitalism is becoming bankrupt. One other thing we should think that it's just going to fold up is they are going to use everything and everything they have in order to stay in power. Yeah. And so we are not just preparing for what comes after them, we are preparing to bring them down. And then there is the other thing is the importance of the worker states, because we are talking about the abolition of the existing property relations, which are those of capitalism, but that has been done in 1917, that was done. And this is why 1917 has shaken the world and has shaken history, because we have entered at that point, humanity entered the point when it could beginning to envisage a world which was going to be for universal good and instead of being for a few. And then the task to actually carry this out has been mammoth. Thousands and millions of lives have gone into continuing the Russian Revolution, and imperialism has put absolutely everything it could to its disposal in order to combat this. And so now we've seen many countries which, like Yugoslavia, which made tremendous improvements and then were blown to bits with weapons, bombed to bits, and then carved up into small states, each one with its own relationship with the capitalist system. So it is a fight that needs our attention, and to be able to argue Marx now is also being able to appreciate the value of the worker state. So there's still worker states today, in our opinion, China and Russia are worker states, and North Korea, I forgot now which others, and also there are forces like the determination, the absolute determination of humanity not to go back to slavery, which is going to win, because even the bourgeois economy has nothing to gain from slavery. It is finished. It's not going to be of use by anybody. And therefore, there's only one way to go. And so our perspective should be to analyze what happened in the worker states when there was, and what's happening in Russia now, when there is that sort of property which is not really strictly capitalist and is not strictly that of the worker state, like I have seen in one of the documents that Ian has distributed. And all that, this, what we have studied today, is giving us means to intervene in there, to appreciate what is Russia today. Because if we do not know what Russia is today, then it's very hard to take a position on Ukraine. And so, I call on the comrades, when we do this discussion for the third, that they go to the text and that they quote the text and that they ask questions, because we don't, many, many things in the text today I did not understand. And so I'm sure this is the same for others. And there's nothing wrong with saying one doesn't understand. Yeah, that's it.
Can I come back
Thanks,
on
Molly. Yeah.
Just on that, I mean, I don't agree that Russia is a worker state, but I don't agree that it's, I do think it's something you have to defend, but for slightly different reasons. I do think it's an anomaly, actually. And I think it's difficult to describe a worker state that's led by a avowed Christian, and Orthodox Christian. I think that's a rather odd scenario. I think it's a very unusual by a party that is openly does not can describe itself as in any sense communist. I do think it's an anomaly. I think the counter-revolution failed, and I think you have a very peculiar situation where serious elements of what was a workers' state are still there, and they're unable to destroy them. But the actual political apparatus is not particularly clear on what it's doing and what its social role actually is. You know, and I think that sums up the ambivalent situation that you had in. I think I made an analogy with France after the Battle of Waterloo, when they attempted to restore feudalism, but they couldn't do it. And it didn't work because feudalism was obsolete and it couldn't be just resurrect it artificially after it had been destroyed. And that's a bit like Russia today, actually. I mean, this is another discussion for another day. But in terms of the third and fourth parts of the manifesto, I think we should do them in one, because, A, the fourth part is very short, and you couldn't do a presentation on it. You might as well read the whole thing out. It really is about three pages, and that's it. And the third part is about communist and socialist literature in Marx's day, and it's very, very different. And some of the things he talks about are a long way socially from where we are today. And it's interesting in academic terms, but whether it's something you could actually devote a separate educational session to, I've got my doubts, to be honest. I think it's it's a curiosity. It's something we could have a talk about, with acknowledging the limitations of that particular section. I mean, we've actually done the bulk of the manifesto. There's a small conclusion, and there's a section on socialist and communist literature, which really is very, very dated, and I don't think we could really profit that much from it. I mean, I think we should discuss some of these things, you know, in a different context. Maybe we should have some discussions on Russia, what is Russia today, what is China, things like this. But I do actually think that we should probably do a forum on the environment at some point as well, because we've actually, between me and Diana, we've written an article on this, which is being circulated amongst us. I've sent you a copy, Marie, as well, which we propose to use as the lead article for the next magazine, which I think is a very good article. And I think we should actually go strongly on this, because this El Nino, this huge heat waves and terrible things that have been going on over the summer are quite startling, actually. And people are denying that there's anything going on are just denying reality, like so many other people are. You know, it's a big thing. It's something very important that we have to take seriously. And we have written about this before, but we haven't written about it as a, you know, we haven't made it such a big issue of it because there's so many other things that are going on. And but I think this is a huge issue as well. And it can't be buried, because there are people who would like to bury it, and the bourgeoisie would like to bury it. Andy Burnham says you should stock up on baked beans. You know, I think for fuck's sake, you know. That's your answer to it, you know. Stock up on tin food, you know. What the that's not going to solve the bloody environmental crisis, is it? You know, something's got to be done. And what needs to be done is socialism, planned economy, change in, you know, change in the use in the way we generate energy to run the modern industrial society. We just need to get rid of this sort of the profit-driven use of fossil fuels. It should have been transitioned away. They are transitioning away from it in China, funnily enough, which is a worker state. And there is evidence that some serious work is going on in China about changing the technological basis of industry. but anyway, that's something we should discuss as well. There are lots of things we need to discuss. But I think this has been a useful thing. I think we should possibly do a...
Ian, can I make this the final call then? And then
Diana.
Yeah, you were mentioning the article we produced between us, but I was planning on adding some stuff about AI to the data centres. I don't know whether you still want me to do that.
Yeah.
But the maybe I can try and do something very brief about them. But Andy Burnham is, well, it was what's his face, the piece of wood that preceded him. I can't remember the Keith, that's his name. Before Andy Burnham now are saying that these data centres are a priority for important national infrastructure, which is horrific. And the damage they're doing, environmental damage. I hadn't realised that Britain's already got over 100 of these things, but I've seen reports about the planned ones. So do you want me to try and add a bit about that?
This is the final call in terms of has anyone got anything to finish off with regards to today's chapter of the Communist Manifesto?
Mm-hmm. No.
Can't see any. So in that case, if I sum up, we can then quick off the recording. So thank you for coming, comrades. It's been a very good discussion. Those of you on the email list will get information on our next regular educational. Okay, you can click off the recording.